This week on Making Contact.
I believe that there is a significant chance that this administration, before it leaves office, will attempt a military strike against Iran.
That's Paul Piller, a former CIA intelligence officer in charge of Iran policy. On this edition, independent producer and book author Reese Ehrlich looks at the Bush administration's efforts to overthrow the government of Iran. Is Iran developing nuclear weapons? Does the U.S. plan to bomb Iran? What do the people of Iran think about U.S. policy? We'll hear the answers to these and other key questions. This radio documentary is based on Ehrlich's 2007 book, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information.
Sean Penn and I walked down a narrow path into the Tehran Bazaar, a huge labyrinth of underground shops and stalls. All our senses were assaulted simultaneously. We smelled the fragrance of savory kebabs and heard the cacophony of merchants hawking their wares.
He's asking if you want to see his carpet gallery.
Oh, is it this way?
Our translator, Maria Majid, suddenly became aware that this would be no ordinary visit to the bazaar.
Many people recognize you here in the bazaar. They're just repeating your name. I can hear it.
Sean, myself, and media critic Norman Solomon came to Tehran in 2005 to interview ordinary Iranians. I began interviewing a merchant named Moshtabor about Iran's attempts to develop nuclear power. Moshtabor also knew a lot about American culture and film stars, gleaned from pirated DVDs easily available all over Iran. Then Sean Penn walked over.
He's going to see Interpreter.
They have it on DVD.
I know that you were married to Madonna. Our knowledge is high.
Great. We come halfway around the world to learn what Iranians think about world events, and they want to talk about Madonna. That's a contradiction of today's Iran. They hate the U.S. government, but have a lot of admiration for America, its culture, and people. Ali Mohammadi is another Tehran merchant.
Many people travel between the United States and Iran. We like the American people, but some journalists come here and make bad reports. That's why the American people think we have problems with them. The American people like us, but the government doesn't like us.
In virtually every interview I've done in three reporting trips, Iranians never express anger at the American people. But there are plenty of Americans angry at Iranians, Iraqis and everyone else in the Middle East. So the question is not, why do they hate us? Rather, it's, why do we hate them? And that's what this documentary will explore. U.S. rulers tell us that terrorists in Iran are out to destroy our way of life with nuclear weapons. The U.S., we are told, has vital interests in the Middle East. Somehow, those interests always boil down to oil and military power. But don't take my word for it. I interviewed a guy in Washington, D.C. who ought to know. Paul Piller was the CIA's National Intelligence Officer for the Near East from 2000 to 2005.
Well, certainly for reasons of petroleum resources and geographic location, whoever is in power in Iran is going to be controlling a country that's very important to U.S. interests. There is the geographic element, specifically control of the Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz. Everyone is quite conscious, not least of all, I'm sure, U.S. military planners, about the capability of the Iranians to cause, if they had the motive to do so, a lot of mischief with regard to either closing the strait or necessitating considerable military measures on the opposite side to keep it open, that is to say, on the part of the United States.
For those strategic reasons, the U.S. wants to have a pro-U.S. government in power in Iran. To do that, it must overthrow the current government and install a friendly one. That doesn't mean that Chevron, Texaco, or other oil companies pound on Pillar's door demanding that the U.S. bomb Iran, or invade Iraq for that matter. It's the job of the politicians, military leaders, and intelligence officers to secure the area. Then the oil companies are natural beneficiaries. After all, who else should get the oil concessions? Again, don't take my word for it. Charles Freeman is a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security. In a Washington interview, I asked him what kind of governments does the U.S. want in power in the Middle East?
It means countries that are not hostile, countries that are willing to work with American companies to provide energy. It means governments that are sufficiently competent to maintain stability rather than to engage in acts that disrupt the flow of energy.
In short, the U.S. national interests is a code phrase for making sure big U.S. corporations make mega profits, U.S. generals have military control, and competing governments don't. But that won't exactly motivate Americans to support U.S. policy. So U.S. rulers come up with a variety of other reasons. We have to stop terrorism. Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons. The image of terrorists with nukes is truly frightening, but it's just that, an image. Is Iran really developing nuclear weapons? Both Republican and Democratic administrations have said yes. For one thing, their argument goes, Iran can't possibly need nuclear power because it has such huge reserves of oil and natural gas. You might be surprised to learn that not too long ago, the U.S. government all but insisted that Iran develop nuclear power. In the 1970s, when the U.S.-backed Shah was in power, U.S. corporations stood to earn a lot of money by selling Iran nuclear generating plants. Ermitas Bavand is a former Iranian diplomat living in Tehran.
We have three treaty arrangements, first and foremost with Germany, with regard to the Bushehr nuclear site. Then we have a treaty arrangement with France and also with the United States. They were supposed to cooperate with the government of Iran for the establishment of 12 nuclear sites.
The U.S. kept encouraging Iran to develop nuclear power even after the Shah, on several occasions, said Iran might want to develop a nuclear bomb. Mohammad Sahami is an energy professor at the University of Southern California and expert on nuclear power. He says U.S. presidents in the 1970s were willing to excuse Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions.
They probably thought that it was in the United States' national interest, both economical interests and, let's say, security interests, to have such close relation in terms of nuclear energy, nuclear power. The Nixon administration or the Ford administration would not have even minded if the Shah developed the bomb because the Shah was a close ally of the United States.
However, the Shah never completed building a single nuclear plant. Western powers blocked all such efforts after the 1979 revolution brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power. Today, Iran once again wants to generate electricity from nuclear power, but says it has no plans to build nuclear bombs. In 2006, I went out into the streets of Tehran as a first step to figuring out what the Iranian government is up to. The mornings are crisp in Tehran in early winter, with snow falling lightly in parts of the city. In this working-class area of South Tehran, a man with a circular saw repairs a small grocery store owned by Ali Mohammadi. While the West frets about a possible nuclear threat from Iran, Mohammadi says his country just wants to develop nuclear power, not nuclear bombs. His views reflect those of most Iranians.
Iran's nuclear power isn't for mass destruction. Americans think Iranians will make a nuclear bomb, and that's why they don't want us to have access to this technology. In our religion, we're not allowed to make nuclear bombs or any kind of weapons of mass destruction. The American government doesn't want any country to have access to technology or become developed. America just wants everything for itself.
Mohammadi says he would like to see relations improve between the U.S. and Iran, but only if the Bush administration's policy changes.
I think the two countries should talk, but the U.S. must respect Iran's rights. Right now, the United States just dictates its positions. The U.S. is losing in Iran. Why should Iran help the U.S. right now?
The Bush administration has a very different view, of course. It portrays Iran as a dangerous threat. But even the CIA admits that Iran is years away from perfecting the complicated technology of enriching uranium and building a bomb, as confirmed by former CIA official Paul Pillar.
There's a long history of Iran evidently experiencing most all the challenges and difficulties in this nuclear program that other proliferators or would-be proliferators have. It's one thing to have a nominal timeline of how long it should take a given power to enrich uranium or develop the various processes that can lead to a nuclear weapon. It's quite another with how it actually works in practice, with all the technical and other difficulties that inevitably spring up.
A country that enriches uranium to generate electricity can use the same process to make nuclear bombs. But USC professor Sahami confirms reports from the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran has experienced a lot of difficulty enriching uranium for nuclear power, let alone for a nuclear bomb.
They would need big cascade of centrifuges. Now, these centrifuges, the type that Iran has, which is P1, which is the most primitive form of centrifuge, they spin at about 60,000 rounds per minute, which is a huge speed. They generate a lot of vibrations, for example. So the vibration should be controlled so that things will not get out of control. Also, the centrifuge should not be contaminated with anything other than uranium hexafluoride. They easily get corroded, for example. Once the centrifuges start spinning, it is not wise to shut them down so quickly and then restart them again. This damages centrifuges. So there are all sorts of technical problems.
So why is Iran insisting on enriching its own uranium, which means violating U.S.-sponsored resolutions passed by the U.N. Security Council? Professor Sahami.
I believe Iranian government when it says that they want to be self-reliant for nuclear fuel. We know that Iran historically could not trust foreign powers for a lot of things, from nationalization of oil to the long history of Russian and British and United States intervention in Iran and all of that. I do believe Iranian leaders when they say they want to rely on themselves.
Is that self-reliance for nuclear power or nuclear bombs?
I don't believe that Iranian leaders want to make a nuclear weapon per se. However, I believe that they consider having the capability of making a nuclear bomb on a short notice in Iran's national security interest. In other words, they want to have a uranium enrichment facility.
It's not easy to determine the intentions of the current Iranian government, so I went back to Tehran to speak with leading critics of that regime. Ibrahim Yazdi is a former Iranian foreign minister and leader of a major social democratic opposition group. Yazdi says the U.S. has offered no convincing evidence that Iran is building a nuclear weapon.
However, I would say even if Iran gets an atomic bomb, what would happen? Nothing. American government is exaggerating the danger or the consequence of an Iran with an atomic bomb. The North Korea has it. What has happened? Except the tremendous economic pressure on the Koreans, nothing has happened. In Middle East, the Israeli government has the largest pile of the atomic bombs. But the reason for the Arab armies defeated by the Israeli army was not because the Israelis, they have atomic bomb.
Some progressives in the U.S. have taken that argument a step further. They argue that Iran may be building a bomb strictly in self-defense. But Yazdi disagrees with that analysis.
I don't believe that even if Iran has atomic bomb, it will prevent attacking Iran. Some Iranian, some military, they argue that if Iran could have atomic bomb, it would prevent any probable attack. But I don't believe that it will, because this kind of war will not be atomic bomb. And even if Iran has it, cannot use it.
Yazdi says the U.S. should negotiate with Iran, allow the peaceful development of nuclear power, and allow international inspectors to do their job. He notes that Iran has quietly cooperated with the U.S. in the recent past, but the Bush administration didn't reciprocate.
The United States government has failed to grab the opportunity, many opportunities that has arisen to resolve problem with Iran, such as problem in Afghanistan, when Iran cooperated fully with the United States government to overthrow Taliban and bring all the Afghani factions together to resolve the problem. However, the United States government did not use that opportunity to resolve the problem. Therefore, there is a great doubt if really U.S. authority, they wanted to resolve problem with Iran.
Professor Sahami says whatever Iran's real intentions, there's plenty of time to ensure the government complies with international treaties.
The Iraqi experience demonstrated that if IAEA is allowed to operate, they can discover things. It's very difficult to actually hide things if they have to do with nuclear material, because they can discover part per billion of nuclear material in air or in soil sample and so on. So it's very difficult to hide it.
Coming up next.
Democracy is something could not be imported or exported. It has to come from within. Democracy is a learning process.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org.
The evening air is dropping towards freezing as my translator and I walk down the flight of stairs to Shirin Ebadi's office. Ebadi won the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize and remains one of the country's leading human rights activists. Ebadi understands the U.S. reluctance to open discussions with Iran and certainly doesn't trust the Iranian government.
The government of Iran claims that it does not want to make nuclear bomb, but the international community doesn't believe Iran. Now, what's the solution? Iran is not a democratic country, and all the decisions are made behind closed doors. The international community can't trust such a government. And if the government of Iran wants the international community to believe in what it says, it should try to bring true, pure democracy into the country. The political solution to energy issue or the nuclear case is democracy.
I asked Ebadi, since Iran will not likely become democratic in the immediate future, what the U.S. and Western countries should do.
I know what Americans shouldn't do. Americans shouldn't start a military attack, and they shouldn't bombard Iran, and they shouldn't interfere with the internal affairs of the country. And the Americans should pay more attention to the human rights issues in Iran.
Numerous times over the past several years, the people of Iran have protested that lack of human rights. In 2005, I attended this demonstration in front of Tehran University demanding women's rights.
She was crossing the street and she was stuck behind a bus. Then she was beaten up and because she didn't follow the rules, and they tried to stop her from crossing the street, and she was trying to go away. They hit her on her legs. Okay. She wanted to take part in the demonstration, but she wasn't allowed in the crowd.
How old is she?
14.
14. Since his election in 2005, President Ahmadinejad has permanently closed many newspapers, arrested political prisoners, and regularly beaten peaceful demonstrators. Women's groups have been among the most active demanding reform. Shirin Ebadi and other women activists held a campaign to gather 1 million signatures demanding equal rights for women. Puran Farrokhzad is a leading women's rights campaigner. She explains that under Iranian civil law, men are valued twice as much as women.
A pregnant woman who carried a baby boy had an accident some time ago, and both of them died. The blood money of the boy inside the womb of that woman is double the amount of the blood money of that woman. So you can see how painful these rules and laws are.
Despite sharp repression, Farrokhzad remains optimistic about the struggle.
The mental improvement of Iranian women is astonishing. astonishing. And she's sure that when all these rules and regulations and discriminative laws are removed, Iranian women can show their true, brilliant face to the world.
Workers and students have also organized against the government. In 2005, bus drivers for the Tehran municipality held a wildcat strike. Shirin Abadi says that event was very significant.
It was very significant in her opinion, but she says that she should mention that workers always have demonstrations. And if you read the newspapers every day, you see that every day workers are protesting in different parts of the country, and or they have the right to do it. Inflation is too high in Iran, and the salaries doesn't help people at all. And because unemployment is a big issue in Iran, if a worker loses his job, he can't find another job easily.
Abadi and other leading opponents of the government say the Iranian people can maintain their own struggles without U.S. assistance. Ibrahim Yazdi says U.S. military actions and promotion of so-called democracy in Iran only hurts the efforts of those trying to make change.
Democracy is something could not be imported or exported. The American soldiers, they don't carry democracy in backpacks. It has to come from within. Democracy is a learning process.
In December 2006, I flew directly from Tehran to the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. There, I met with leaders of all the Iranian Kurdish guerrilla groups opposed to Tehran. They all had Peshmerga, or militias, training in northern Iraq. This group proudly sang one of their revolutionary songs. About 20% of Iran's 70 million people are Kurdish. They face discrimination and repression. Only one group, however, the Party of Free Life, or PJAK, carries out guerrilla raids inside Iran. The U.S. seeks to take advantage of regional and ethnic discontent with Tehran to pursue its goal of regime change. And PJAK is happy to cooperate. PJAK, closely associated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, is a very strange cult. In the 80s, it claimed to be both nationalist and Marxist. Today, it has jettisoned Marxism, but kept the nationalism and cultish adulation of its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, now jailed in Turkey. I interviewed Zinar Agri, one of PJAK's top leaders, at a guerrilla camp in northern Iraq.
Before, the Kurdish people did not know about their history, about how to struggle. But Abdullah Öcalan came through his philosophy, found how to try to get the rights of the Kurdish people.
Agri studied every other sentence with praise to Öcalan. PJAK has fallen so far into the U.S. orbit that it's the only Iranians I spoke with, inside or outside Iran, that wants the U.S. to bomb Iran.
We are happy if U.S. will bomb Iran, because it may cause change of the regime, because we have this common aim. Our struggle is to change the regime.
Kurdish sources told me that PJAK gets arms and training from the U.S. and Israel. Seymour Hersh later reported the same information in The New Yorker. Agri denies the charge.
It is baseless, not true, but we would love to have cooperation with the U.S.
I asked him if PJAK was accepting arms and training from Israelis.
Nothing like that happened, but if there is an offer of support by them, by Israel, we welcome it.
PJAK has killed Iranian police, revolutionary guards, and civilians inside Iran. Ironically, the U.S. is supporting the kind of attacks inside Iran that it accuses Iran of making inside Iraq. The U.S. plays the same game with a group called the Mujahideen al-Khalq, or MEK. They are former Marxists who opposed the Shah of Iran and fought fiercely against the clerical regime in Tehran. But they later sided with Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War and lost all credibility inside Iran. These days, the U.S. protects them inside their base camp in Iraq. I asked former CIA official Paul Pillar if the U.S. is using MEK members to carry out terrorist attacks in Iran.
I don't have specific information, but I think that's very plausible, everything we know about the Mujahideen-e-Khalq and what they've tried to do over the years. Now we've got this strange sort of relationship in which most of them are sitting in this camp, surrounded by, but reportedly at times sharing chicken dinners with, American forces. But I think we did make a mistake in seeing the MEK as a tool we could use and as something we did not want to crack down on because it was a good weapon that we could perhaps use against or at least hold over the head of the Iranians. The MEK are terrorists. We should have no truck with them at all.
Leading Republicans and Democrats have gone along with these policies as a method of overthrowing the government in Iran. They agree on applying diplomatic pressure, economic sanctions, and trying to politically isolate Tehran. But they differ on whether outright military attacks on Iran will be effective. Abbas Milani is a political science professor and director of the Iranian Studies program at Stanford University.
There is a camp that is close to Vice President Cheney, and they think that this regime in Iran is an incorrigible regime and that the only way is to take them out. And then there is another camp that thinks that the Iraq lesson has been very serious and they don't think that Iran is an easy target and that they want to try to see whether they can work with the EU and with Russia and China to bring economic pressure to get the Islamic regime off its nuclear track. Both sides ultimately think that this regime is up to no good and that the only long-term way that the U.S. can coexist with them is if there is a regime change.
Former CIA official Pillar says that the Bush administration has failed to learn from the disastrous war in Iraq.
I believe that there is a significant chance that this administration, before it leaves office, will attempt a military strike against Iran. I hope that does not happen. My personal view is that would be a major blunder, even though if it were an airstrike, it wouldn't involve all the occupation-type problems we've involved in Iraq. Nonetheless, the consequences, ranging from Iranian retaliation against U.S. interests to the less direct but still very deleterious effects on U.S. standing and interest in the region and worldwide, would be severe. And at the same time, we would have no assurance whatsoever of undoing or critically damaging whatever program the Iranians do have.
In late August, President Bush told a veterans group that Iran could start a nuclear holocaust. The rhetoric bears an eerie similarity to the bombast and lies leading up to the U.S. attack on Iraq in 2003. This time, the stakes may be even higher. Should the U.S. bomb Iran, anger will spread throughout the Middle East and around the world. Fighting could well break out anew in Lebanon and Palestine. U.S. troops would come under increased attack in Iraq. The administration risks more chaos in pursuit of goals that have nothing to do with the interests of the American people. For Making Contact, I'm Reese Erlich.
That's it for this special edition of Making Contact, written and produced by Reese Erlich. This radio documentary is based on Ehrlich's 2007 book, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. He reported from Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Iran, and Iraq. Special thanks to Dan Turner and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 3907, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Puck Lowe associate producer, Matt Fidler sound editor, Samson Rainey and Joaquin Palomino interns, and I'm senior producer Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.